Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work, or subconsciously, or in a different way. Today, I'm very excited to have actor and director Jordana Spiro with me. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Please let me give an introduction to Jordana and her work. Jordana started out her career as a working actor, appearing in TV series like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, If These Walls Could Talk, Undressed, and Cold Case. Yeah, we went back there.
Wow.
You may remember her from the TBS comedy series, however, My Boys, where she played a young woman surrounded by male friends trying to find romance, which I think resonated with a lot of women who had a lot of male friends. After My Boys, she appeared in a number of indie films like The Year of Getting to Know Us and Anna McKay's The Goods Live Hard, Sell Hard, with recurring roles on The Good Wife and Blindspot, and amongst other shows as well. I'm like culling from the herd. Jordana took a step towards the streaming life when she was cast opposite Jason Bateman and Laura Linney in Netflix's critically acclaimed series Ozark, which is now entering its second season, and you can see that on Netflix now. In between all of this, however, Jordana directed the short Skin, which premiered at Sundance and won her the 2012 Women in Film Calm Down Productions Grant. She then graduated from the MFA in film program at Columbia University and received the Adrian Shelley Foundation Fellowship. It's a big deal. Adrian Shelley Fellowship.
Yeah, that was a real honor.
Pretty big deal. Tells her you're doing something right. She wanted to move further into directing, so she began developing the story for her first feature film, Night Comes On, with writer Angelica Nwandu at the Sundance Labs, and came away with the CineReach Development Grant for the project. So Night Comes On, which premiered theatrically in August, tells the story of two sisters who were abandoned to the foster care system after their father killed their mother. When the older sister turns 18, she searches out the younger and takes her on the run to track down their father and kill him. This movie that Jordana picked out, she tells me that she didn't even know that there were some parallel themes to it.
I didn't even realize it at the time, no.
She chose Charles Laughton's Night of the Hunter as her fave genre film.
Didn't even dawn on me that night was in both of the titles.
I know. I was just like,
really
wait a second. I was like, was this an inspiration for... Anyway, if you could give me a quick explanation for, you know, why you wanted to talk about it.
Well, you know, I thought one of the fun things about this show was getting the chance to just talk about, you know, sort of uber genre kind of films. And I had recently just watched that, just kind of came across it on Turner Classic Movies.
Oh, yeah.
And just thought it was the wackiest, weirdest, most bizarre and playful kind of film I had seen in a really long time. I mean, he was just doing the weirdest stuff in that film, and so for that reason alone, I was like, "Ooh, that would be a fun film to talk about." And you know, through getting the chance to talk about it, get to learn a little bit more about it myself.
Yeah.
So that was really actually the only thing going through my mind. I was like, "Oh, that would be a cool one."
And then it turns out your movie is a sequel. So for those of you who haven't seen Night of the Hunter, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Night of the Hunter first, please be my guest. And now that you're back, let's introduce Night of the Hunter with a quick synopsis. Written by James Agee and directed by Charles Laughton for release in 1955, Night of the Hunter tells the story of two kids in Depression-era South who go on the run from a psychopathic preacher played by Robert Mitchum. We meet Preacher as he's fleeing another murder of a widow. His M.O. is murdering widows. It's a terrible person. And he's snatched up by Johnny Law for driving a stolen car. Meanwhile, we meet Ben Harper, a poor man who shoots two bankers and makes off with a stash of money, which he hides in his daughter Pearl's dolly. Ben's son John watches in horror as his dad is arrested. In jail, Ben's rooming with Preacher. Ooh, that's not a good mix. Ben accidentally reveals that his kids know where the money is that he stole. And so when Ben's executed and the preacher is released, he marries Ben's widow, Willa, played by Shelley Winters. Preacher charms everyone in town but John and Pearl, who see through his thin facade. Eventually, Preacher kills Willa and dumps her body in the river, but tells the town his wife abandoned him and the children. A townie discovers Willa's body, but is threatened into keeping secret for fear people will think he murdered her. But here's where the story really takes off, because left alone with the kids, Preacher's on the hunt for that money, and the kids are not going to give it up. There's a chase, and the children escape from Preacher by taking a raft down the river, where they meet Rachel Cooper, played by Lillian Gish. Rachel takes in stray kids and vows to protect John and Pearl when Preacher shows up, and there's an all-night standoff between him and her. Meanwhile, the police figure out Preacher is a killer and head to arrest him. Rachel injures Preacher with a gunshot. Preacher's eventually caught, but it doesn't soften the blow that John and Pearl lost both mother and father all over a little bit of money. It is everything. It is everything.
Yeah, it's. I think the final line of the film is Lillian Gish talking about the two kids and saying about children, they will abide and they will endure.
Yeah,
which I think is a beautiful final line.
It is so sweet. It is just such a wonderful movie, and it's something that I try to introduce to young people. Mm. There's a high school of all girls that I had watched Night of the Hunter this year, and they came away with it being their new favorite film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so I'm telling their teacher to listen to this episode because they liked that movie so much. So please listen, you know, to this episode, rewatch your favorite movie now, Night of the Hunter, and then watch Jordana's movie.
Well, you know, that right there is a testament to I think how we don't appreciate the sophistication of young watchers.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Yes, very smart. Mm-hmm. I mean, the stuff that I wanted to watch when I was a kid, I think back to that and I was like, you know, of course I wanted to watch Spaceballs, but yeah. I also was very into, you know, darker material.
Yeah. I think I had maybe a slightly too young viewing of Jacob's Ladder that I probably regretted at the time.
Yeah, I think most ages are too young to watch Jacob's Ladder.
I'm still too young to watch Jacob's Ladder.
One of the things I wanted to talk about with this movie is that Lawton began as an actor and was primarily an actor, and he was putting on these small dramas and traveling theater before he made this movie. Hmm. So it was very popular at the time for him to just travel around and to put on these dramas that were scripts that he didn't want people to lose. He wanted to make sure that these old stories were still being told. So, you know, he had a really prolific film career, obviously, very well known, but he was doing this traveling circuit. And that's when he actually first started trying to direct, was on the stage.
I didn't actually know that.
Yeah. And so he honed a lot of his skills just by doing that, especially with working with actors. You know, in that time, Lawton's only, I mean, like his best known roles were like The Hunchback Quasimodo, 1939's The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is like amazing. And he was generally like the go-to guy for any role of gravity for a middle-aged, slightly portly British actor. So he was directing
anybody with a commanding voice.
Yes!
Go to Charles Lawton.
Exactly. Like a commanding voice where you're like, oh, someone who's going to be in charge, who might be a buffoon, who might be sweet.
I'm not sure how drunk he is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's phenomenal. And it's lovely to go back and see his movies and be like, wow, that's the guy who made Night of the Hunter. But he was directing on stage and enjoyed that and met this young producer named Paul Gregory. Paul gave him Davis Grubbs' novel Night of the Hunter, and it was everything that Lawton loved. It was a gothic children's story that straddled horror and drama.
Right. There you go.
And Lawton said it should be made into a movie, and Gregory convinced him that, you know, that Lawton, that he was the guy who should direct it, which is crazy. He's like, you know, you have this young guy. He's just like, no, no, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're the one who's supposed to tell this story.
Yeah, completely.
But the second that Lawton accepted that, he spent hours talking off Gregory's ear about his ideas until it was 2 a.m. and Gregory had to send Lawton home. And I am curious, mm-hmm. because we do get a lot of actors turned directors who come onto the show. You know, I think that's kind of becoming a natural trajectory for a lot of women who are trying to work their way into the industry. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, as an actor yourself, what was the moment like when it hit you that you should be telling stories from behind the camera?
You know, for me, it was a kind of a cumulative effect of several things. You know, I've always loved writing, so I write a lot, and I co-wrote this and, mm-hmm. and Skin as well. And so I've always written. I've always had a very big passion for photography. But it didn't dawn on me to ever see myself as the storyteller.
Yeah.
It just didn't really dawn on me. And then I think once I'd been in the industry for about 10 years and started to see that I wasn't really feeling like I was making any kind of contribution, any kind of, I wasn't really getting to say much as a as an artist, if you will.
Yeah.
Short of very few parts here and there, My Boys being one of them,
mm-hmm.
That I started to wonder whether or not I should just get out of this business.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something more meaningful. And I started volunteering in a lot of different places. And one of them was with a foster youth organization. And I started to just see other stories that were really inspiring to me. I mean, other lives that were really inspiring to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, I started watching films like Lynn Ramsey's films, like Lucrezia Martel's films,
yeah.
Jane Campion's films. And again, it didn't actually dawn on me that these were all women, that I started to see, like, wow, I feel like I might have something to say, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a, you know, that's kind of how it dawned on me. And then I knew that I wanted to have a foundation under me, and I wanted to learn it as a kind of a real craft. And so
yeah.
I left L.A. and went to New York, where I'm from, to go to school.
You know, so for Lawton, it seemed like it was like a dam burst. Like, all he needed was someone to give him permission.
Mm.
And so when Paul Gregory gave him permission, it was like, yes, I already have these ideas and I just needed someone to say that I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have anyone who gave you permission, or was it?
I mean, it's certainly a collection of friends and people around me that would encourage me to not think I'm totally crazy, to sort of take a break from this career that, you know, I'd been working in and making a living in, which is a mm-hmm. hard thing to do, and kind of stop it and move away from it and go back to school or go to school. I didn't go to college. So certainly I had, like, people around me that, you know, encouraged me to do that. And then there were plenty of people that were like, you're crazy. What are you doing? Just direct something. Like, if you want to. And I felt like I didn't really know what my voice was, or I didn't have any command over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go and develop it and take time to figure out what it is I want to actually say, or what I want the camera to do.
I mean, you're hitting on something that I definitely want to talk about, which is his collaboration with Cortez, the cinematographer.
Mm.
It is incredible. Their relationship was so wonderful and sweet. It's one of those. Let me talk about Cortez and introduce so people know who he is. Stanley Cortez met Lawton on the set of The Man on the Eiffel Tower. I think that was back in the 40s, 30s. And then again when Lawton appeared in an Abbott and Costello picture, both of which were shot by Cortez. So the two men had this really beautiful admiration for one another, which you can see in interviews with Cortez specifically. But Cortez described their working relationship as thus. Cortez would come over to Lawton's house to explain basic filmmaking things like lenses and cameras to Lawton. But Cortez says that he would come away from their discussions having learned so much about the philosophy of story and storytelling that he said it had totally changed the way that he worked. And so Cortez had been collaborative before, but he never thought so deeply about story and character. So when they would get to the set, Cortez would just set up a shot he planned and be like, okay, I'm setting this up. And then the actors would step into the place and do their take. And then Cortez would take this in and then often realize that he would need to completely reset up the shot, usually playing with the lighting to add or subtract to get the right tone, because the actors would completely transform any of the words on the page. And he was just learning that through working with Lawton and working with these seasoned actors. And so it's just, if you talk about the kind of like no rules, just kind of rolling with it. That's exactly what they had on set, especially with the cinematographer.
Oh, that's interesting. And yet, at the same time, there are these like extremely planned out stylistic choices.
Mm-hmm.
I was just reading that because, you know, the whole river scene, this incredible river scene.
So beautiful.
The horizon, you know, when the kids are in the barn and they hear him singing.
And you see the silhouette
and you
in
see
the background.
The silhouette.
Yeah.
Well, that was all stage. All the river, everything was done on a sound stage. And I guess to get the forced perspective, they had a miniature pony.
Yeah, they had a miniature pony and then a little person
riding. And a little
riding.
Person, right, yeah. Right.
It's so amazing.
I mean, you know, that takes some – it's not like they were just like, what are we going to do today? You know,
yeah,
who
exactly.
knows? The world's our oyster. You know, everything was really planned out. But then there was also this – it seems like there was also this incredible freedom and playfulness too.
Well, they only had 38 days to shoot this film.
Is that right?
And when you have something that is this technically oriented, that's not much time.
Yeah.
It was made for not much money at all.
Turns out they were shooting on film back then, too.
But I'm curious about the influences for how to get, like, the right visual look. And so I want to come back to that. We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to talk a little bit about the visual references of both your movie and Charles Laughton's film. So one quick break.
It's new promo time, James.
Ooh, what you got in that guy?
How about this? You need more black friends, Minority Corner, every Friday.
Okay, but girl, that doesn't say anything about how we're a podcast that talks about queer issues, race, politics, and pop culture.
Now it does, because I've already hit record.
Oh, girl, you so sneaky, you be Linda tripping me.
Minority Corner.
Learn, laugh, and play.
All from a perspective that's black, queer, and ladylike.
Because nobody puts minorities in the corner.
Every Friday.
And welcome back. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here joined by Jordana Spiro, and we are talking about Night of the Hunter. So Laughton was really obsessed with the silent film era, and especially obsessed with D.W. Griffith, who directed the unequivocally racist film, Birth of a Nation, that I feel like we should mention that. But he also irrevocably changed the aesthetics and process of cinema itself. So Laughton studied every Griffith film he could get his hands on to prepare for making Night of the Hunter. He watched them multiple times, taking notes, studying composition and performances, and especially editing and structure. He was very interested in how they handled that. And he knew he wanted to add these elements to Night of the Hunter. He didn't like where the film industry was heading and felt there had become a loss of art. And so this was actually his chance to bring the movies back to this realm of visual art. And you know, you don't need the dialogue in this movie. You can tell what's happening through the pictures, but at the same time, the dialogue adds something. And that's what he wanted talkies to be. It's just like, if you're going to have dialogue, it should definitely add something beyond, you know, expository or something like that. And so I want to talk about the importance of kind of having these references to develop a visual style and to kind of teach yourself into what you want things to look like.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was it's a lot of photography, in particular, Mary Ellen Mark, mm-hmm. Brenda Ann Keneally were two photographers that we referenced a lot.
And Mary Ellen Mark was very famous for going into a lot of difficult places and documenting.
Yeah, she did a documentary called, I believe it's called Streetwise, mm-hmm. That followed, I think, five young teenagers who were homeless in Seattle, I believe. And there's a photographer who's working now, Petra Collins, who we looked at a lot. And then films that, you know, we were trying to juggle two things when Atwe and I were talking about what we wanted. On the one hand, I knew that I wanted it to be very subjective. I wanted us to really feel like we were strapped on this character's back and going through everything with her. Mm-hmm. That was very important to me. And then at the same time, trying to find this poetry or this kind of magical realism moments and these little those kind of poetic details that that let you in on a more sensorial experience, that you're showing something that words can't express.
Yeah.
And so we were always trying to find those moments as well.
If we're talking about like these themes, you mentioned something earlier before about the idea that, you know, filmmakers may be obsessed with something and potentially not know it or just, you know, be working out their own demons through their art. And I wanted to make sure that we brought up the fact that Laughton led a really complex life being a Catholic man who was also very unsettled by the Catholic Church's teachings because he was a gay man who was closeted for most of his life. And he was told he was an abomination. And still some of the performance that he did as a traveling showman was also dramatic performances of the Bible, which if you go back and try to find any videos of that, they're beautiful. He turns the Bible into this very vibrant Shakespearean drama, you know, just this one-man show. But it's
which
one
is
those...
really actually interesting because he gives Lillian Gish that moment in the film,
yes,
too, where she sort of, you know, calls them around for storytelling time.
Yes. It's something that you can tell he was very connected to in this movie. I mean, this is a story about children, but this is also a story about, like, you know, being loved and forging through, like, the hypocrisy of someone's religion and, mm-hmm, and trying, mm-hmm, to survive that and come out to be okay.
It's funny that you say that, too, because on this, that when I watched it yesterday again, I was thinking about how Robert Mitchum's relationship with God. I was wondering, like, is that, because it's funny, too, right,
yes,
what he's saying. So is that, is he messing with us? I mean, is he, or is that, in fact, the preacher's – does the preacher think he's actually having a genuine relationship with God?
It's one of those things where, like, I think subsequent watchings, I feel like he is and he does have a relationship with God, but it's his own God.
That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly.
Right? And that's like – and, you know, he talks about that when he's talking to Ben Harper. He's just like, you know, this is between me and my God, and, like, this,
right,
is what he tells me.
What religion you profess, preacher?
The religion the Almighty and me worked out betwixt us.
And, you know, you can see so many people who think they're talking to God, who do so many terrible things, you,
right,
know, like they think they're driven by this higher,
right,
purpose,
right,
but they're not.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a really beautiful statement, you know, because it's not saying that, like, religion is bad altogether. It's saying, like, there are people who will use it as a weapon, and there will be people like Rachel who will use it to protect.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And it's a really beautiful story that I hope he got to work out some of his issues.
Yeah, having
through.
Said that, then he never directed another movie again.
Well, we'll get into the reception
figured,
of that because it is
would.
Like, oh my God. But I think, you know, like, Preacher is a villain for the ages too, and, you know, Robert Mitchum wasn't comfortable actually talking to God in the movie. Like, he wasn't comfortable with that element of, like, when he opens up and he's talking to God about the widows.
Lord, you sure knowed what you was doing when you put me in this very cell at this very time. A man with $10,000 hid somewhere and a widow in the making.
He was actually unnerved that someone would do that.
Hmm.
Like, it was a limit for him, and he eventually got past that. But it was a limit for him,
right?
That he didn't want to. But I mean, like, I want to talk about the fact that your movie, you know, Night Comes On, that's not close to your personal experience, but it's also something that perhaps you can work out, something that you identified with, that you
yeah,
you found
I mean, you know,
there.
It's funny because it started from a very biographical place for me in the essence of the film, what
yeah.
it's, you know, what it's about, which is why I think it is universal. I was trying to develop a story where it was about a young woman who felt lost and who felt directionless,
mm-hmm.
which is where I was, and who was so aching for a purpose that your mind starts to wonder, like, what if one could take on a purpose that's ultimately self-destructive,
mm-hmm.
For two reasons. A, for the feeling that you know what you're going to do when you wake up the next morning,
mm-hmm.
and B, because ultimately you don't want it to continue.
Yeah.
So it's like a suicidal mission of sorts. Not
yeah.
that I ever necessarily, you know, grappled with suicidal ideation, but just this kind of idea of, like, just wanting to know what you're supposed to do with yourself, and you'd give anything just to know that.
Yes.
And then at the same time, as I was in this kind of search for what else I might do, and I started to be around these young people, who were aging out of foster care and understanding what that journey is like, to me it seemed a lot more interesting and important to set the story with those given circumstances, because it allows the possibility to shine a light there. And also I think sometimes it's easier to grapple with your own stuff through a metaphor sometimes. And then also, you know, on top of that, it was just a real admiration for what the resilience of these young people, because for me, I always had safety nets around me. And so the idea of, you know, sitting in these kinds of existential crisis feelings and yet having no safety net around you was just something I was blown away by the way that these young people that I was meeting, you know, handled that incredible difficulty that I feel like I would crumble with. So in that way, I always was able to kind of infuse my own feelings and my own heart into the story. And then as I, you know, kind of developed it, and I knew that I wanted it to be very meditative, and I knew that I wanted to be able to sit in some feelings and some real character development. Having said that, I don't really love films that are, you know, straight portraiture, that don't have a narrative thrust, where you don't get to see the arc and you don't really understand the story that you're watching. I like beginning, middles, and ends. And so...
How traditional of you.
I know, right? I like that classic kind of filmmaking. And and so so that's where, you know, I thought about the revenge idea. And that she would want to come out and want to kill her father in this way to protect her sister, and yet she's not thinking about the fact she's devalued her own significance to such a degree that she's not thinking about the fact that what her sister needs is her. And she doesn't have a plan for afterwards. Anyway, so when I kind of come up with this idea and I started to write the script, it just felt like I didn't really feel right writing this in such a kind of a specific and nuanced way about aging out of foster care without writing it with somebody who could speak to that experience firsthand.
So you found Angelica Nwandu that way. I'm curious what your collaboration was like, because if you look at the collaboration between Charles Laughton and James Agee. Agee had written, like, came back from having Grubb's book, came back with a 250-page script.
Right.
And it was, you know, everyone who read it was just like, it is beautiful. It is the best script I've ever written. It could never be shot.
Right.
So Lawton's big thing was kind of paring down. Like, his art was paring down these beautiful scenes that Agee had crafted. And Agee was from the South. He was from Tennessee, had written an award-winning book about Depression era poverty in the South. And so he had this authenticity that everyone knew was going to be amazing. And it did. It really heightened this picture, and people just connected with it, and that kind of desperation of what people might do when they're put into these circumstances. And so that collaboration turned out to be really beautiful. You know, of course, Lawton was working on the script like right until the day that they shot it. But it was
likewise.
But it was definitely a collaboration. And also the way that they all three agreed that Grubbs would have first position credit. You know, because they loved his novel and they were like, we've never seen any book that can be so cinematically portrayed as something like this. And so they just had such immense respect for what each person was putting into the process. And I just really appreciated that. But how did you and Angelica work? You know, what was the process back and forth between you?
You know, it had a mix of different methods. It was a lot of talking, a lot of brainstorming together, a lot of discussing where the story was when I had reached out to her. Trying to build from there and unpack what feels real, what doesn't, what are, you know, her educating me on the details of the emotions and mm-hmm. and some very specific anecdotes of what it's like to be in care and to come out of care. For me, it was downloading to her a lot of films that I thought were interesting.
What did you send her?
Things that we watched, and we would watch them together and discuss them. And so some of the things we would watch, of course, a lot of neorealist films. Bicycle Thief, of course. Mm-hmm. And then things that have a kind of a kind of a poetic lyricism, I guess you call L'Adelante and Los Olvidados. Mm-hmm. And then one that's more current that was an interesting reference for us was Oslo, August 13th. Is it Oslo, August 30th? August 13th?
Now I don't remember.
Now I'm all of a sudden. But that
it's
was
whatever
really,
you say it is,
that,
Jordana.
That was a huge thing. That was a huge movie for me because it really unpacked for me, like, I mean, it really showed me what you can do in the course of a day. Because that film takes place over a day and it's certainly an existential crisis. I mean, he's very, very much trying to figure out whether or not he should essentially have a drug overdose.
Yes.
And it has this vignette style. And I knew that that was something I was interested in and couldn't quite wrap my head around how to achieve that. So that was a big key for me.
So you get to just kind of take notes on the structure and, you know, how they transition from one thing to the next.
Right. And actually just give myself permission. In some ways, that film gave me permission to let this character walk through these conversations.
Yeah.
These different conversations. And have a reference where that felt very much, very, very compelling. So then we would just, I had the outline and the scenes so it was who felt at the moment that they had a really good grasp of mm-hmm. of that scene. Okay, you or me. Okay, great. You give it a shot and then we'll swap them and build on them, re-swap them mm-hmm. or come together and write them. So it was a lot of different, you know, different ways of going about it.
But very
constant
fluid.
Discussion. Yeah.
Yeah. So much talking.
Yeah, so much talking.
Well, you need to make sure everyone's on the same page.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the discussion for us, if I reflect on it, came from we have so much that we wanted to say about how deeply broken the system is. And yet at the same time, where it's such a delicate balance of making sure you're not making a pamphlet. We're mm-hmm. not making a documentary. We're not giving a lecture. We're trying to tell a story, and a story that on the one hand can inspect and share some of the really deep problems within the system, share the resilience of the youth that come out of it, and also at the same time be a universal story that anybody, including myself, who was not affiliated with the system in their upbringing, mm-hmm. Could feel themselves in it, could feel that relationship with their sister, with your brother, with yourself.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I want to get back into some of the nuances of working with actors as a new director.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one quick break.
Hey, this is Griffin McElroy.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
And we've got a new podcast on Maximum Fun called Wonderful.
Wonderful.
It's an enthusiast podcast where we talk about things that we're excited about and things that you're excited about.
Things like overalls.
24-hour Sudafed.
The grand prize game.
The fact that wombats use their butts to kill predators.
The soundtrack to the movie Dick Tracy.
The beach potion we call Bud Light Lime.
All these things and more every Wednesday, and we'll also talk about things that you're excited about.
You can find us on MaximumFun.org or iTunes or wherever. I don't know, just search Wonderful. Google it, you'll probably get there.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jordana Spiro, and we're talking about Night of the Hunter. Let's talk about performances, because the way that Charles Laughton directs is phenomenal. He actually takes techniques from the silent film era. He slates only once and reruns the scene giving direction in between, trying to make sure that he clips his instructions so it doesn't run over the actor's lines.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I do that. I do that too.
Tell me.
Yeah, yeah. Especially for children. I find that to be especially helpful for children because it allows you to be in the moment with them. And mm-hmm. so, like, I just call it side coaching. Where for kids specifically, for me, it helps to be in the feeling of the film with them mm-hmm. Because they're beautiful absorbers of feeling. So if you're kind of not giving them line readings, but acting alongside with them, it gives them a kind of a partner and it frees them up to go into an emotional place mm-hmm. Because they're doing it alongside you. And so I like to do it. So when I'm, you know, giving feedback or giving notes, it's in that same energy or in that same feeling of the scene.
Yes.
For an adult actor, I think that can sometimes be or could potentially be distracting.
Yeah.
Because they're coming in with their own homework.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of depends on the actor's needs. But I do find myself doing that a lot especially with kids. And it drove my editor, who was awesome, crazy because, of course, it's like, you know, one take, but it's like 17 minutes long. So
mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons I think Lawton actually did the first cut of this movie himself, because he was like, well.
Right. I think I'm the only one that can tell you where the good stuff is.
Yeah. But there's a documentary called Directed by Charles Lawton, and it is.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
Yeah. It's fantastic. Oh. And it's all behind the scenes of this. And there's a lot of you watching Lawton coach an actor into exactly the right performance. And so often it would be like the last one and he's like, nope, we got it. We're done. And so that made it slightly easier where at least, you know, they knew that they were working up to a specific emotion, a specific point, and then they moved on. And it was fine. But it's a lot of energy. It's a very interesting way to run a set. And for those of you, the listeners who haven't been on a film set, there's a slate, you know, like they click the board and it's got like take one, take two, and they just do it every single time they reset. With him, of course, they're just, you know, one slate click and then it's just acting, which is so much energy. I love that the adults loved it too.
Yeah. I mean, as an actor, I love it because it just lets you get into a role. It lets you get into it's more energy actually to stop. Everybody disbands, then so-and-so over there is fixing something that they could have maybe waited next take, but now that we stopped, I might as well do it now.
Yes.
You know, and everybody, and then, you know, the hair and makeup person will come in and touch you up, whether or not you needed it, but some
it's
actors
just part
just
of the mechanisms.
And all of a sudden, everything just sort of disbands, and you've got to gather that up again, as opposed to, actually, it's much easier to sustain a feeling when you're in it than stopping and now building it up again and then stopping and then building it up again. So especially for emotional stuff, I tend to really like it when you can just stay in it.
I mean, after watching that documentary, I was just like, yes, this seems like the way. It seems
like,
oh
my God, this is so exciting. I got to see this documentary.
Oh, it's so fun. It's so fun to watch an actor's process as they're coming into the character and into the scene. And it's one of those things where Lillian Gish and Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters equally loved having that kind of direction. And they, you know, they had their own ideas coming in, but they also gave themselves over to Charles's process because they knew that Lawton was so respected as an actor.
Right.
They were like, it's an honor to be directed by you however you would like to direct me.
And from what I understand, like I heard Shelley Winters talk about being directed by him and saying that he was very respectful to her process mm-hmm. Because, of course, she was bringing in this essentially new idea through the actor's studio and this new mm-hmm. way of working and that he could really run alongside of her with that method.
Yeah, he just loved it.
Yeah, yeah. They came up with an analogy, apparently.
Is it the spider?
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
So I'm like a fly attracted to the spider.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah, that's perfect, which is kind of interesting, in fact, because then in the river scene, you have that totally bizarre and awesome over the head shot where you're seeing the children, you know, flowing down the river through a spider web.
Yep.
So I was wondering if that was decision inspired by their
metaphor.
It has to
be, right? It has to be. It's just when she said that in the interview, I was just like, yes, that is exactly that character. And you embodied it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was,
mm-hmm.
it's just a beautiful performance.
Yeah.
And everyone – and I'm always curious about this because there are the stories from Lillian Gish that she came in with some ideas of her own. She said, okay, well, what about this? I've got some ideas. And Lawton's first reaction was oh no, I did something wrong.
Yeah, and I heard that too.
And that's the funny, like, it's
to
it's,
the point where she was like, I guess we should all just stop telling him our idea.
Like they
he's too collaborative.
Like having like a quorum with all the actors where they're like, we'll never tell him any of our ideas. We'll do them if we really believe in them, but we'll never say anything because his confidence is so low.
Yeah, and yet what's funny about that too is if you heard that anecdote without having seen the film, you'd think, oh my God, this must be like a mishmash disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's such a specific visual idea. It's such a, I mean, it's so his own thing.
Yes.
So it's funny that that's how he could be feeling. And yet that's clearly he was very in command of exactly what he was doing.
But I mean, I think that speaks to the whole like getting a chance to direct, you know, it's very rare. Like, and who gets to direct a story that they really believe in mm-hmm. that often, you know?
Right.
He's working in a studio system that also didn't know what to do with him, you know?
Right. And didn't know what to do with the film after.
Yeah, they're like, what the hell is
what
this?
What is this?
Why did you make this movie about
apparently
children?
Apparently there was another Robert Mitchum film that was much easier to sell, so they sort of, you know, dumped all their support into that film and let this one, you know,
no
out to
surprise.
Dry.
Yeah. Well, this one also didn't get great reviews either.
Right. It was panned.
But I mean, sometimes I like going on Rotten Tomatoes and seeing movies that are at around 65%.
Right.
Because sometimes those are the ones that really broke through and people just didn't know how to interpret them yet.
You know, it's funny. I think like there's some. There's something to that is when it's genre, I think.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, Ozark, I think it sort of hovers around there. And yet it seems like people really, really love it.
They get into it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And yet I think for sort of artsier, smaller, mm-hmm. quieter films. I'm not sure that the correlation is the same, but I think for sort of that real kind of popcorn-y sort of entertainment film, I think there is a link missing.
We'll have to take an independent study of this.
Yeah.
And to see if they actually, because I stand by it. 65. Look,
we're
for the
doing
65.
All right on Rotten Tomatoes for Night Comes On, though. So don't take that as a
sign not to
see the film.
No. You guys are doing like, could you imagine if Lawton had the kinds of niche audiences that have developed today? You know, like this is where people see that and they're like, yes, I want to see this like beautiful drama and I want to go out to Lemley Theater, my independent theater, and support this, you know, story that I'm interested in seeing that
Do
I don't know anything about.
Do you think that's happening today in a forceful way that sort of helps?
It's a slow avalanche.
Mm-hmm.
It is a slow avalanche.
Right.
But I think it's potentially happening. I mean, you get enough people talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes Twitter is good.
Yeah.
Most of the times it's terrible.
It's the devil, but
sometimes it's okay. I want to talk about something that you brought up earlier in this episode about the music and about the haunting music of this. I don't want to overlook that because it is so important, and it is, I think, so important because he had his composer come on set and be on set for the entirety of the film.
Mm.
And it was a really beautiful collaboration between Cortez, the cinematographer, Lawton, the director, and then Walter Schumann, who was very famous for composing the music for TV's Dragnet. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, you're kidding.
Many of us can remember that.
The film in Night of the Hunter is just, I mean, the music is just extraordinary.
It's wonderful. It's, so one of the things that he did, the reason why he came to the shoot, was that Cortez and Lawton were shooting the scene in the bedroom on the wedding night, right? Mm-hmm. You've got Willa and Preacher, and Willa's like, oh, now's the time we'll make love. And Preacher's like,
right,
you've basically born two children.
Yeah.
You know?
Is that one of the most incredible scenes?
Oh, my God. Just the play of space in
so
that kind
terrifying.
Of like cathedral, like ceiling. Oh, my God. And it's so terrifying. But Cortez was trying to set things up, and he had this thought, and he was like, Lawton's like, no, tell me what you're saying. And he's like, oh, I don't want to say it. And finally, Lawton dragged it out of him, and he said that he thought the scene was playing out with the rhythm of a waltz. He's like, I see this as a rhythm of a waltz. And Lawton immediately agreed. He was just like, the way that he agreed with her, he was just like, yes, you're so right. He had just so much enthusiasm that he called Schumann up immediately and said, you got to get down here. We're shooting this, and I need you and Cortez to work together to like envision the scene with the music so everyone like would know. And so that just speaks to Lawton, I think, being an artist, you know what I mean? Not just like a filmmaker, but an artist. He can see the kind of abstract ways in which these things can fit together and envision them and kind of bring them to life. But that music is incredible. No one has their composer come to set.
Right.
He had his editor on set as well, completely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, both of those things would have been an incredible luxury.
Yeah, could you imagine?
For me, we would not have been able to afford that. I mean, that would have been an extraordinary luxury. We had, you know, I'm actually interested, and I don't know if you know this or I don't. Yeah, I'm curious to know if you know this. The little girl that sings that song, I actually heard her singing it. There was a YouTube clip that I found, so may have been from the documentary that you're talking about. Where he has her singing that song in the rowboat.
Yeah.
And then they replaced it with a different voice.
Once upon a time, there was a pretty fly. He had a pretty wife, this pretty fly. But one day she flew away, flew away.
And her voice was extraordinary. And I'm wondering, I'm so curious now to know why he felt to replace it. Because it was really a mature child's voice. I don't know. It was very compelling. So that's my one. That's a curiosity of mine.
This is where we get to critique Night of the Hunter, though, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, maybe you should have kept that.
What a terrible idea, Charlie.
Every first-time filmmaker gets to make some mistakes, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I was just curious. I don't know if it was a bad record. I'm just wondering, like, if it was a technical reason why they did that, or
I don't know.
It was a creative reason.
Maybe Schumann was just like, no. This does not fit with my vision.
Exactly.
You know?
It must be, yeah. But for us, you know, I had, I was a big fan of Alluvium.
Mm-hmm.
And we had even put one of Alluvium's songs into the screenplay with just the hopes that we would be able to get it.
Yeah. Usually those are high hopes, right? Because you're just like, at least I'm writing it to this music, but perhaps I won't get to have it.
Exactly. And I had a sense for me that I knew that I wanted the score to be very beautiful and simple but layered. You know how some really, really good ambient music can have, you know, it sounds like it's a 17-minute song and they're doing nothing. But in fact, the reason why it can put you in a kind of a state is because it's actually doing so much. It's doing so much, but it's doing it so perfectly simply that you don't know how it's, you know, working on you the same way, of course, like a ballerina makes it look easy.
You don't know how the sausage is being made at all, but you know it's being made somewhere.
Exactly. You know it's being made well. And one of the reasons why that was really important to me, because there was I was getting feedback initially that, like, well, don't you need a lot of, like, hip-hop music or something in the film? And that would have been fine if for me that felt organic, but I would have felt.
Is it because you have black characters?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think so. And I just thought, well, but the whole point of the film is to give her this kind of inner life that we don't get access to, mm-hmm. and this grace and elegance, and not that that doesn't exist in hip hop music, obviously, but it's not an organic way for me to get. I don't have enough
like
knowledge.
Ambient, like, I mean, I guess the way I'm thinking is like ambient organic, whereas like if you're talking about hip hop, it feels much more intentional. Like there's an intentionality or something to the way that it's constructed.
No, just organic to me that I don't have the kind of encyclopedic knowledge. Mm. It wouldn't come from me. It would be because it's what you're supposed to do when you have black people on film.
Okay, yeah.
And it would have been an external idea that wasn't coming from me. Mm-hmm. So it just didn't feel like my way of creating a kind of a quietude for this character.
Yeah.
A gracefulness for this character. It would have felt like something you're supposed to do and not something that you're doing because that's what the character is telling you to do. Mm-hmm. So that's why we went that route. Just trying to find trying to create a meditative space for her.
Was that something that you faced a lot of the time where you just, you know, you felt like you were trying to find ways to go against a grain?
Not go against it, but not appropriate something because that's how it's supposed to be, or that's because that's how people tell you it should be. So not to go against it just because you want to go against it, but because you're trying to create something that feels unique to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you created a very unique film, and I'm so happy that you're able to talk about Charles Laughton with me and his unique, only directed one time film.
I know, what a shame.
It's but
I
you
wish
know,
there could be a part two. We were like Charles Laughton, his next film, but unfortunately not.
It's just not the way it was. But if you can only make one amazing film, you know, that's not so bad.
That's right. It's a real gift. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Night Comes On, you can see theaters, VOD. Where are we going
to? That's right. On iTunes, soon to be Amazon, and Google Play.
Wonderful. Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at switchbladesisters@maximumfun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/Switchblade Sisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.